Well, thank you for having me here. It's a good turnout, and appreciate you having me and for your interest in these topics. Sarah asked me to tell you a little bit about myself, so I'll give you the very short nutshell, which is I've been in journalism for 30 years, and for the last 20, I've mainly focused on covering religion. First, as a freelancer, mainly working for an outfit called Religion News Service, and covering religion at various points in North America and in Europe. And then for many years for the Louisville Courier-Journal. And as you probably know, that is home to the Presbyterian Vatican, the headquarters, and they had a seminary in town too, so I got a Master's of Arts there. And so a couple of years ago, the position opened up here in Pittsburgh, and so I actually came from the Presbyterian Vatican to the Presbyterian Poland, kind of the heartland of Presbyterianism, I guess, but of many other things as well. One of the things that's interesting about Pittsburgh and southwestern PA is just how diverse it is religiously, in different ways than Kentucky. You know, Kentucky has its own diversity. If you say you're Baptist, the next question is, of course, what kind? And a little bit different here, but talking about religion and in public life, I was working on a title for the talk, and I was even fine-tuning it since I had sent my working title to Ted and Sarah, so I came up with something like Meet the New Culture War, same as the old culture war, only different, only more of the same. So maybe I can start by asking, when people talk about the culture war, what does that mean to you? What do you think they're talking about, and what do you think it means?
Conservative versus liberal.
Things like they used to be versus things how they are now.
Mm-hmm. How they used to be versus how they are now. Sir?
People being against rather than for.
People being against rather than for. Hmm. It's very interesting, and I think it'll tie in that mostly what you're describing are attitudes, dispositions, rather than particular issues. Because a lot of times, when pundits talk about it, and I guess I'll plead guilty to punditry at times, it's often talked about as religious, mainly Christian conservatives mobilizing against particularly abortion and gay marriage. Those are, and gay rights. Those are usually the two issues that are often identified as front burner issues. I think it's more complex than that, but those certainly have often been the battlegrounds, the presenting issues. And so I'll start with a story. And Sarah, let me ask, I'm hearing a little bit of a buzz. Is that just me, or is that...
I think it's because we turned it up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
so if I need to move anything, just let me know. So, okay.
You can put up with it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can put up with it for sure. Okay, so I'm going to go back to the year 2003 when the state of Massachusetts legalized same-sex marriage. It was the first state to do that. In 2004, just a year later, states across the country, particularly in the South, the Bible Belt, but elsewhere as well, began drafting proposed constitutional bans on gay marriage to prevent their state courts from doing what the Massachusetts Supreme Court did. And these were all destined for the ballot for November of 2004. And no suspense, I'll just say outright, they all passed, 100% of them. But in the run-up to that, where I was living at the time in the state of Kentucky, there was a veteran but vulnerable elder Republican Senate running for senator running for re-election, Jim Bunning. You may remember him for throwing a perfect game as a Major League Baseball pitcher in his first career. In his second career, his politicking was less than perfect. And by 2004, he was making very bizarre public statements, including comparing his opponent, who was Italian-American, to Saddam Hussein's sons, who had just been gunned down in Iraq. Now, aside from Rick Pitino and Calipari and others, Italians are very rare in Kentucky. So when you make a statement like that, it plays to certain attitudes that you may not find in a place like Pittsburgh, where, you know, people are much more familiar with a much larger Italian population. So anyway, he was still facing a lot of criticism for that and for other things. It was a very close race. He had a very strong opponent. But the Republicans rallied to him as their candidate, and they also happened to rally heavily to this constitutional amendment that was on the ballot. And everywhere that this amendment passed by a wider margin, Jim Bunning also won by a wider margin, and he ended up winning the race by less than one percentage point. And I think it is very fair to say that if this amendment was not on the ballot, the motivation for a lot of his supporters to get out the vote would have put his election in real doubt. We'll never know. You can't run a controlled experiment in an election, but I think it's very reasonable to say that that amendment saved his Senate seat. Now we're going to fast forward 11 years. 2015, the Supreme Court of the United States legalizes same-sex marriage nationwide, and all of those state constitutional bans were considered null and void. And most of the country by then, there had been a radical change in public opinion to the point where when these constitutional amendments kept getting put on the ballots in other states, they started to fail. And some legislatures were actually passing these things rather than waiting for judges to were passing the approval of gay marriage rather than waiting for judges to do so. So by 2015, pretty much everyone was ready to accept legally the opinion, except for a certain county clerk in the state of Kentucky, Kim Davis, who defies the case, goes to the mat on it. Long story short, federal judge rules she is in contempt of court for failing to do her duty, sentences her to jail. Eventually she gets out, and they work out some sort of workaround, but her attempt to stop gay marriage in Rowan County, Kentucky, fails. Federal judge who decided that case, anyone know his name? David Bunning, the son of Jim. So the Bunning name bookends kind of both ends of this as a public political controversy. Now, this is not to say that a Bible Belt state like Kentucky has suddenly turned into Massachusetts. Not by a long shot. After all, this is the state that has produced Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, who succeeded Jim Bunning in the Senate, not to mention the Creation Museum, the Ark Park, a Tea Party governor, and a big primary win for Donald Trump. And I realize we're not in Kentucky, but we are all familiar with the phrase Pennsylvania, the region between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, so certainly this comes close to home in some ways. So, however, in contrast to 2004, the issues are clearly different. When the Pew Research Center surveyed voters on the issues they felt were very important, there was a major division between the supporters of each candidate. The Trump supporters were far more likely to cite as serious problems immigration, terrorism, crime, and the need for good-paying jobs. The Clinton voters were more concerned about the widening gap between the rich and the poor and the environment. Both sides were equally concerned about race relations. Now, the survey didn't elaborate, but I think it's safe to say each side has a different take on race relations. What's striking to me is that the Pew survey didn't even ask about abortion or gay marriage, which are two salient issues that you would have asked about in past elections. Now, they still are salient, but more as rearguard issues rather than vanguard issues. In other words, nobody anywhere is talking about the same remedy that they thought about in 2004, which is, okay, if the judges pass something, let's pass a constitutional amendment to override the judges. No one is talking about a constitutional amendment on marriage. It's not even on the table. Instead, mainly you have appeals for religious liberty, for defenses for the Kim Davises of the world, or for vendors, photographers, bakers, caterers who don't want to cater to a same-sex marriage on conscience grounds. They're saying they should not suffer penalties for discrimination if they're acting on conscience. Similarly, we have the ongoing challenge to an aspect of the Affordable Care Act, where you have faith-based institutions, and the lead plaintiff in this is Pittsburgh Catholic Bishop David Zubik. You have them challenging mandates that they say are against their conscience, in which faith-based institutions such as Catholic Charities and Geneva College, should these schools be providing contraception coverage that they oppose on conscience grounds? And that case is still pending. And, of course, we do have the bathroom wars. But these are not, I would say, the front burner issues that come up in the presidential campaign. They may be an issue for the NCAA, but not for, I don't think they will come up. They might come up in the debate next week, but I don't think they will. In fact, one of the biggest measures of our political divide is a basic question that some of you brought up already. When asked, has life gotten better off or worse off for people like you over the past 50 years, Americans overall say it's gotten worse, 47% to 36%. Now, among the Trump supporters, 81% say it's gotten worse. Among the Clinton supporters, only 19% say it's gotten worse. 59% say it's gotten better. More of them, I think, say it's stayed the same. So the question is, who are, quote, people like me? As far as I know, the survey didn't ask. But it's well known people take on multiple identifications. You can be any number of things at the same time. But it's also well known that two of the biggest predictors of how people are going to vote are race and religion in combination. Overall, and I'm talking percentages here, nothing, no individuals, but overall, if you are white and identify as Christian, chances are greater that you're voting Republican in general and Trump in particular. Now, if you're part of what I call the Obama coalition, a majority of the minorities and a minority of the majority, you're probably voting Democratic and Clinton. By that coalition, I mean black and Hispanic Christians, Jews, followers of other religions, and the fast-growing secular population, and a minority of the white Christians. And I realize now, actually, I can no longer say a minority of the majority. I have to say a minority of the plurality, because the total number of white Christians, Catholic and Protestant, is actually below 50% now. So again, you ask, who are people like me? A lot of it has to do with this identity, which can often come down to a tribal identity. So you also don't hear a lot of the targeting of gay people that you, in political circles, as you have heard in past elections, usually not by the candidates themselves, but by their surrogates. But even that, it just doesn't even seem to be registering this year. Mainly this year, the question is, you hear a lot about Mexicans and Muslims. to put it succinctly. There's a Presbyterian sociologist I got to know well in Kentucky over the years at Center College. His name is Bo Weston. He studies a lot about the interplay between culture and religion and politics. And what he has said is the name of the other has changed, but the fear of the other is exactly the same. And he said, if you look back at how polarizing the issue of abortion was in past years, where people could just hardly even talk about it, today that seems to be the issue that sounds most like today is the issue of gun rights. If you start talking about guns, you usually either stop talking or start shouting. And he says, not everyone is on board for the next culture war, but there is a next culture war. And there are some on the Trump side. There are some Christian. There's been a lot of ambivalence on the conservative Christian circles. Some who just cannot vote for either major candidate. Some who see Mr. Trump as a champion. And there was one very prominent Dallas pastor who put it, I want the meanest, toughest son of a you-know-what I can find in his corner. And there are many, including many prominent pastors, who, no matter what questions they may have about Trump's lifestyle, about the casino business, and other things, they see his promise to appoint anti-abortion justices as paramount, and that will cause them to hold their nose and vote for him. They don't see a case for holding their nose and voting for Hillary, and in fact, many, even what you might call, kind of defining more the Catholic position of the seamless garment of issues of social justice ranging across a number of issues, but also including opposition to abortion, there are many people in that camp who are probably going to abstain because they don't feel Hillary has given them anything to hold their nose for, frankly. The platform is about as liberal as it's ever been on abortion, and they don't feel like she's even given them anything to say, well, I'm against torture so I can vote for you because there's some sort of room for compromise there. So this is these are some of the quandaries that religious voters of different perspectives have. On the Democratic side, what's interesting is you do see cases where Hillary, who is a lifelong Methodist, does cite her liberal Protestant social justice values, that her faith gives her an impetus for supporting the poor, for supporting education, for supporting the disadvantaged, and the same is true for her vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, who even has, I would say, his biography seems to show more genuine religious participation and elements. I do think while Clinton and Trump both have a public stated religious commitment, we've seen them in public for a long time, and they strike me as the most secular candidates we've seen in modern times, with the possible exception of Michael Dukakis. So, changing cultural wars or not. If we go back to what is often marked as the beginning of the kind of modern conservative religious resurgence in politics, 1979, 1980, with the start of the Moral Majority, even then, it wasn't just about particular issues, as important as those issues were. It was also about the notion of a Christian America. Do you believe America is or was a Christian nation, as opposed to a kind of a more, a vision of a secular state where all religions and no religion are free to practice and flourish or not, as they choose, more of an e pluribus unum vision. Generally speaking, though, if those who will cite the Christian identity of the nation will tend to vote Republican in general and for Trump in particular. So in a sense, this is a battle of religious visions. On the left, it's maybe a Micah 6 vision, which is do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. And on the right, you have more of a Second Chronicles vision. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven, forgive their sin, and heal their land. A notion that the nation collectively needs to repent and turn to God and vote the right way. In this sense, you could hear the moral majority hearkening back to the Puritans, who were routinely calling for fast days. You notice we like to keep the Thanksgiving tradition, the idea of a feast day going. Nobody ever kept the fast day alive. That didn't sound nearly as fun. So that brings us to today, where we're still talking about the issue of who are people like me, and am I better off, or are my people better off? It kind of reminds me a little bit of an episode in All in the Family. Did any of you used to watch that? Where George Jefferson says to Archie something about, I can't believe what it is about you people. And Archie says, who are you calling you people? You people are you people. And the identity changes, but that does seem to be one of the biggest drivers of our divide in this current election season, is a sort of sense of there's us and there's them. And people, I get the sense people are voting as much on that as on any issues. So, you know, when people look at what a candidate said and can you believe what she just said or what he just did, will that even make a difference if people have already kind of chosen up sides? And I don't know the answer to that, but I strongly suspect that's why we see such persistence of support among candidates, that we don't see as much movement as you might think based on events happening in the campaign. I could probably prattle on a little bit more, but why don't I stop here and pause for questions and ask your take on things. Sir?
In the work you do you find it difficult to be, quote, politically correct and totally objective? Kind of a general question.
In reporting, you mean?
In your thinking and reporting, yeah.
Well, mainly in the reporting, it's a matter of, it means calling people and meeting with people who I may or may not personally align with, but listening to them and learning of them and about them. It goes with the job.
Yeah. So there's a professional role you play, but then there's a personal role which you, as private, you're supported for that.
Right, yeah. I mean, everyone's entitled to the personal views and opinions, but when it comes to the public realm, reporting, I try to, as best I can, to get all sides of the truth.
Sure. Last month there was a back and forth, a letter to the editor, a woman who was Catholic and said you can't invest in Catholic and support Donald Trump for all these reasons. You should support Hillary Clinton on the issues of immigration, treating the poor, torture, just as you said. And the rebuttal had one point, and that is Clinton's support for abortion. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it seems to be the defining in that segment.
Yeah.
That's the defining issue.
Right.
Without regard to anything else in the election.
Mm-hmm.
Not the economy, international affairs, it's who's going to support abortion, who's going to appoint justice for reverse.
Right. No, I think that's a good observation. And I do find that even among such supporters, you do tend to hear some spill over into other issues like terrorism and things like that. But generally speaking, I hear it that discussed as sort of a non-negotiable issue. There are some who will say that is a non-negotiable issue and will not vote for Hillary Clinton, and then they'll point to things that Trump is doing and say these are non-negotiables too, so I can't vote for him either. There are different schools of thought on that.
I get the impression you're coming at this that party is less important than tribe. I don't know whether it's true or not. It seems like there's been a lot of talk about people changing the registration all your sisters, more than I recall. People changing the registration of the party they're associated with more this year than I recall in any other election in recent history.
Generally, it is hearing reports of more people changing party registration than in the past, and I certainly have heard that. And I think in some cases that may actually be cases of realignment coming up, where, for example, you've got Democrats traditionally had the working class vote, and Trump is getting a lot of the working class vote. So you may have had a lot of people who say, "I want to vote in the primary." You know, 20 years ago the union signed me up for the Democratic Party. Now I want to vote in the Republican primary. So you do have some of that, and I think some of it, I think, was just a matter of these primaries being so high profile that a lot of people realized, hey, I'm an independent, I can't vote. I need to sign up with one or another of these parties so I can vote for or against someone. Just going to get some water here. Yes?
You're probably not old enough to remember, but we talked a lot about the religious right. I can remember a time when there was what I would call the religious left. Where there was a very strong voice for social justice, against poverty, against racism, for peace and justice in general. And, you know, we can probably remember the characters that led that. Martin Luther King, certainly. Oscar Romero, we all remember, at least I remember that person. A lot of people who were fairly public about their faith commitment to justice issues. Do you see that now at all?
I do see it, and I think even in the Democratic Convention, there was a bit of a resurgence of that, particularly with Tim Kaine talking about it from the Catholic social justice perspective. So I think that voice has always been there at various levels. I don't think the mobilization on religious identity was anything compared to what happened on the side of the Moral Majority, Christian Coalition, and related organizations, just in terms of sheer mailing lists and get out the vote and mobilizing mainly on religious grounds, on religious identity grounds. More I found it as a voice within the campaign, and certainly, we certainly know about the political mobilization in the black church, which is really unparalleled. Again, among many white mainline denominations, you have the voices like the Sloan Coffins and the Jim Wallaces that have certainly had a voice, had a reach, had an audience. So it's not that it isn't there at all. I don't think that they're symmetrical in terms of their approach or their influence.
I recently moved from South Carolina back to Pennsylvania, and I realized that all of a sudden there aren't as many black people around as I was used to in South Carolina. Do you notice that having moved? I don't know about Louisville, whether that's they have a lot of blacks there or not, but that tends to change the way the culture feels too.
Yeah.
Do you pick that up at all?
Well, that's always hard to gauge, to eyeball, because neighborhoods are so segregated that it kind of depends on where you spend a lot of time. And so I don't, you know, compared to the South, I don't know what the percentages would be. I mean, you could make the argument that many Southern states are actually becoming more integrated than the North.
Well, probably so. And of course, yeah. I think that changed this issue about cultural yeah. wars too.
Yeah.
And has a lot to do with, can have a lot to do with the election.
Yeah. Well, sure. Sure. If you know somebody of another race who is dealing with the issues like, you know, fear of police, Black Lives Matter, and you hear them say what it's like to be pulled over for an issue that they don't, you know, that they think was not justified, that helps you put a face, a name to an issue that otherwise can seem abstract, and, you know, you would just, it would be harder to, it's harder to dismiss when there's a person on it. Same with immigration too, is you have a lot of times, you have a lot of evangelical churches, for example, starting Spanish congregations and reaching out to immigrants, and the next thing you know, they're advocating for them in a deportation hearing, and all of a sudden the issue no longer looks as black and white. Now, how that affects voting patterns, I don't know, but it certainly has muted. You know, one of the biggest mobilizing forces on the right traditionally has been the Southern Baptist Convention, and in recent years they've called for things like, I believe they've called for a path to citizenship for people who are not currently in legal status. I could be wrong on that, but they certainly have had much more conciliatory approaches on that issue. So.
Please. What do you think Citizens United has done to our political process?
I don't think I have anything very original to say on it. I think it is.
There's a lot of people that don't even know what that is.
Yeah. I think what has the Citizens United decision, what has that done to our political process? Citizens United basically gave unlimited ability for corporations, unions, anyone with money to advertise as much as they want on politicians, on for candidates and political issues. And I think it is, it has so greatly amplified the voice of money, because you can buy more airtime that way, that it's hard. I have not studied this directly. This is a couple steps removed from religion, and so I just haven't actually reported on this much, but I have to think this has had a huge influence on what we think, you know, what our take is on an issue. So.
The candidates now, it seems like Hillary Clinton is not really historically surprising. But Donald Trump seems to be so different from other, you know, candidates that I guess we're familiar with. Can you think of any historical parallels anywhere to the Trump phenomenon historically?
Not as a major party candidate. The closest I can think of is George Wallace.
So what about other countries and just if you're familiar with world history?
Well, what it has reminded me of, and I've written about this actually, is some of the fictional candidates in American politics. For example, there's a novel by Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, in which you have a candidate speaking on behalf of the forgotten men, which is an exact phrase from Donald Trump's acceptance speech. And basically rallying religious conservatives and the out of work, the down and out. This is set in the Depression, but he ends up winning the presidency, and within days, the American democracy is over. You know, the Supreme Court is defanged, the Congress is defanged, and it becomes really a military state. And so it's a very dystopian vision but it was based on, and so if you're looking for real life parallels, it was based on similar kind of strongman movements in Europe where people felt, well, in fact, this is even quoted in the novel, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. You got to sometimes break some rules to get things done. And at that point, the country was in the middle of a depression. Europe was in the middle of a depression. You had some strongmen who said, like Mussolini, who said, we can, you know, just, we can do this. We can make the trains run on time. But some of the traditional democratic processes were eliminated in the process, even though they came to power through democratic processes.
The unfavorability rating of both candidates is so low.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what your sense is in terms of those who will choose not to vote in this presidential election.
So,
how that will affect things out there.
Given how many people view the candidates unfavorably, how will this affect people's choice not to vote? I think it will. And who knows, in some of these battleground states, it may all come down to Pennsylvania, actually. And some of these battleground states, that could be a huge tipping point. I really.
One way or the other?
Yeah, one way.
I mean, do you sense that it would help Trump or help Clinton?
Would it help Trump or help Clinton? I don't know. I can see enough people deciding that in either direction, you know, they would otherwise lean toward this candidate, except, you know, he or she has gone over the line just one too many times for me. So I don't know. It's very disconcerting to have two of the most unpopular candidates ever, whoever wins, taking over at a time when there's been such paralysis of government. It does not bode well.
Have you done any research into what the EPC is putting out there? The
EPC?
Evangelical Presbyterian Church?
In terms of what? In terms of politics?
In terms of how to approach which ticket to put a letter on.
You know, I haven't looked and I haven't heard.
Might be worth a look.
Have you found anything on that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have a sense that they're trying to make it palatable to vote Republican.
Okay.
But I don't know how they're going to do that. Mm-hmm. So I find it to be kind of fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're not the only organized church that's trying to make that case.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Please.
What do you see as the lasting effect of Trump's, and I don't think there's any question that he's been able to communicate, speak to a large portion of the population that probably felt that they had been underrepresented in the past. What do you see as the lasting effect on the electoral process of that? And kind of coupled with that would be the effect on the Republican Party, so-called establishment. Is that history? We've gone to a more populist, party.
So, what will the effect of the Trump candidacy be on future politics? And you know, some of that will depend on whether he wins or loses. I think if he wins, obviously he controls the party, and so it will continue to take on more and more of his image already, and that may well translate into candidates. I mean, we've already had a whole series of candidates in state primary elections that have really adopted the Trump persona and platform. Paul Ryan even had a very aggressive challenger in Wisconsin. He'd lost by a landslide, but he certainly was a harbinger of the what a candidate would look like in the image of Trump if this continues. If he wins, I think that will move the party and really leave the establishment wing really trying to figure out what to do, whether to support or to somehow break off. My guess is, historically speaking, they tend to coalesce around whoever is the candidate. So I think they will probably find their way back in. But I don't think it'll be easy. And if he loses, then I think there's going to be a real battle. And I hope that's only metaphorically speaking, because you know, with the combination of the discussion about are the elections rigged, and frankly, the repeated talk about guns, I cannot but worry that there could be election violence and post-election violence. Many of these voters have not voted in a long time that are supporting Trump. Will they be discouraged and go back to non-participation, or will they renew their efforts and, you know, try to get more grassroots mobilizing, and or will they, I don't know, will they find some other path to activism? I don't know.
This might be more of a legal question, but following the strongman theory, if Trump does win and removes much of the political infrastructure of the country, what would be left? I'm talking about the courts, the administrative structure, the legislative structure.
Right.
I guess the Constitution would remain, but what else would be left?
I don't know. That's. A lot of the rule of law actually depends on consensus. You know, there's the famous quote attributed to Andrew Jackson in the ruling about the Cherokee and Creek Indians, where he says, "The Supreme Court has ruled, now let them enforce it." In other words, he drove them west out of, I believe, Georgia in defiance of a Supreme Court order. So then the question is, okay, what does the rank and file do? Is there going to be people further down the chain who will say, well, I've got one order coming from the president, I've got another from the Supreme Court. How are they going to decide? So I think, you know, I've learned not to make major predictions, but if there is a challenge like that, if a president wants to defy a Supreme Court order, I imagine the headlines will then be, what does this governor do? What does this police chief do? What does this military commander do?
That we have that right now. Really?
Yeah. And it's usually assumed that they'll answer to the established chain of command, right? Usually. I mean, usually if the president says go to war, they go to war, but we haven't had a case where the Supreme Court has said, no, this president cannot make this order. So then I don't know what they'll do. Sarah, you had a question?
Why do you think the media focuses so heavily on the evangelical Christian right to the point where, at least in my opinion, the secular people in this country, the definition of Christian becomes that particular brand? Why?
Well, they are organized and mobilized, for one thing. There's no question that evangelical Christians are, you know, have successfully organized as a political bloc for more than a generation. We do our best, we as in religion writers do our best to identify the different segments of the population. But if we do too much, maybe because they're the most outspoken about
it. I'm thinking more of youth media yeah. really is a clue into religion. Mm-hmm. So they end up truly representing American Christianity.
Yeah.
And to me, that's very troubling. And
yeah.
I don't know how we go about changing that.
Yeah. Well, until recently, too, they also had the growing numbers. And as I recall, they may still have some pretty good numbers, either plateauing or growing, although it's becoming more ethnically and racially diverse. So when you describe evangelicals, you're no longer just talking about a white Southern Baptist in Charleston, you're also talking about an African immigrant or a Latino immigrant who may have a very different take on what's the most important issue to vote on. But when you have one set that who has strong numbers and another set of Christians whose numbers seem to keep going down and they seem more divided and diffuse on where they stand on issues and less mobilized. And, let's face it, by definition, progressives are less easy to give marching orders to. They're just, liberals are just more individualistic, and that's sort of part of the territory. So we just need to keep working at it and do as good a job as we can to point out what is the diversity of opinion among Christians, taking into account who's certainly got stronger constituencies or more mobilized. That has to be taken into account, but not to the exclusion of others. So, and I agree that the perception has really damaged the perceptions among younger people who are more secular, and it's widely considered to be actually feeding into the growth of more secularism among younger people, both and to more liberal politics too.
Yeah, I'm just sort of falling into a line with what's been said, and that is that I notice even on a TV station like MSNBC, which is, I guess you would say, left-leaning,
mm-hmm.
when they have someone on there to talk about religion, they've got someone who focuses on the family, mm-hmm. or someone who's very much part of the religious right, and mm-hmm. it's as though there are no voices coming from the left that are speaking out of their faith commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's because it isn't as exciting as what's coming from the other side, or I don't really know why that is, but it does trouble me, I would say.
Sure.
Why are religious people so timid? Other than the religious right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, why are religious people other than the religious right so timid? I don't know that all of them are. I mean, you certainly do have a strong religious left. Begin with the Black Church, and you have very activist among Jewish and some other groups. I think there is a very strong contingent. But numerically, I don't know if it's quite as strong or even necessarily as effective. But I think you can point to a number of maybe quieter successes on the left. I think one thing that maybe one more recent example of a success, and this is in coalition with others, but the whole idea of prison sentence reform and a recognition that of the damage a criminal record can do to someone for life. And this particularly has fallen hard on the African American community because of the high rates of incarceration that they've had. And a somewhat related issue is, do we treat drug addiction as a crime or a disease or something like a disease that needs treatment? And there's been a much greater push toward treatment than in the past. And these haven't been exclusively religious issues. And in fact, some of them have even brought in what you might call religious conservatives, or at least in the big tent definition, in which they're adopting more issues than just a few signature ones. But certainly, I think the religious left has been on these issues for a number of years. There may be a contingent that kind of sits quietly and agrees more with positions on the left than gets out in the street and does something about them, but that may be true on the right as well.
It seems like applied religion occurs more on the right than the left.
And you might argue that some on the left would say, well, it doesn't have to wear the brand to be the motivator. They would say, you know, solving hunger doesn't, you know, we may come at it as a religious value to solve hunger, but we can work with others who come at it from other motivations, and we don't have to put, you know, stamp our Christian brand on it. You know, well, you know, look at something like Shem, you know, interfaith ministries means something different than Christian ministries, or so. Impact Network, right.
Because that seems to be an interreligious group that is making some efforts.
It is.
I don't know that they're widely known, but...
No, they're not as... I'm not sure that any of the interfaith groups are all that well known, but they come out of a movement that started in Chicago under a name we heard a lot about back in the first Obama candidacy, Saul Alinsky. It's a community organizing method that has throughout the country mobilized churches and synagogues and probably mosques as well to galvanize around a particular issue, and usually a very concrete one, and then raise their voices, do protests, or do lobbying, behind-the-scenes work, and often they'll have a big meeting. So if imagine we have a meeting like this, but maybe 500 people in the crowd, and I've invited the mayor, and I've said, Mayor, will you commit to... and I might have something very specific, like... adopting whole language reading curriculum in the public schools, you know, something like that. And of course, the mayor doesn't run the schools, but you get the idea. And so here he is on the spot in front of you, and he either has to say yes or no. And if he says no, he's probably going to be booed. If he says yes, then they say, okay, we'll have you back in a year, and we're going to tell you whether we think you've met your promise or not. So it's very high impact, high. Well, the way the Europeans call them, pressure groups, it's high pressure. It uses the power of numbers, of persuasion, arm twisting. They use street protests. A couple of years ago, a lot of people from Penn were out getting arrested protesting the wages at UPMC, for example. So it's a very activist group, and it might be in distinction from another type of interfaith group that concentrates more on service to the poor without trying to lobby to change the system. They may want to change the system, but that's not their stated mission, their portfolio. And then you have still other interfaith groups where you sit around scratching your beard talking about how we're all similar and different. That's called dialogue. That's a different... And that can be more valuable than how I just characterized it, but there are different types of groups, and so that's this group's particular bailiwick.
Do you know about the name Bread for the World?
Bread for the World?
Bread for the World, do you know them?
I've heard of them, yeah.
They are a lobbying group.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. I do get their press releases, yeah. So.
Yeah. Are the elections rigged? In your opinion?
I don't think they're rigged from within. I mean, I'm not covering the system, so I'm not speaking out of reporting knowledge or anything. I'm confident they're set up in good faith. Now, whether they could be hacked, I have my questions now, based on what we've seen in recent months, whether someone from the outside could hack into the system and at least cause havoc, if not change the results. So. Sorry?
In Pittsburgh, which religious groups do you see being active in politics, being outspoken and making stands, or what do you see in Pittsburgh?
Depends on the issue. You see some, you see black churches mobilizing on issues of particular concern to their community. You see Christian Associates, which is an ecumenical group, which is, it's a very impressively broad coalition of Protestant, Catholic, and Christian denominations. There isn't a whole lot that they agree on, but where they can agree is on issues like refugee status, welcoming refugees, combating hunger, fighting religious prejudice. So you see them make statements on that. You do get some, there is a very conservative group called the, something like the Pastors Network, where they'll rally on bills like regulations regarding abortion. Certainly the Catholic Conference is very influential. They just helped organize blocking a bill that would have opened up the church to lawsuits going back. And then that's more of a self-interest thing than a political issue, but it did involve political organizing. I probably should think of more, but I don't think of any that have been kind of a huge amount of clout, and that may refer to the whole religious diversity of this region. So are there some that you can think of that I'm overlooking? Have I worn you out? All right.
Serious?
Please.
Rather than looking at it from a religious perspective, historically, I think we can look at it from a realistic perspective in terms of what each party has accomplished. In other words, if other black communities are better off today than they were before, is there more violence and more black violence in particular cities? And what has the community organizations done in those communities that have basically helped the black people in terms of developing businesses, schools, and housing, for example, or has it been a destruction of property of people? And if you look at that and the family structure as well, and if you look at the realistic accomplishments of each party in terms of what they've accomplished, rather than the idealistic ventures of attitudes, you have to then look at not necessarily the attitudes and opinions, but the realism of what has been accomplished. And that, to me, overrides from a perspective of religion as well as community involvement what has been accomplished. And that, I think, is going to have some bearing in terms of what the public sees from a secular perspective as well as a religious perspective. It
would be interesting to see if voters will take the time to research that.
Or if the media addresses it.
Yeah, you see a lot of research into a particular candidate's record, but I don't know if you see as much into a particular party's record, which might be harder to quantify, but it that would be... I would like to see that.
Definitely in Detroit, mm-hmm. they've been Democratic for about 50, 60 years. Mm-hmm. You can see the same thing in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to criticizing the situation, it becomes... A racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a racial issue. It's all black
mm-hmm.
in both cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so by pointing out that it's a racial issue, it's not as realistic as looking at it from the perspective of what the Democrats in Detroit or Baltimore or any of the big cities that they hold sway. Philadelphia, where they hold sway,
mm-hmm.
have they held themselves?
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, you have to judge what the community organizers are actually accomplishing.
Mm-hmm.
Have they improved the schools or the health care or whatever?
I think it's looking at how the political systems have worked would be good, and also recognizing other forces in play as well. What's the economic forces? You know,
exactly.
If it's not just a city, isn't just run by its politics. You know, if major employers decide to pull out and leave the wreckage behind, that's another issue. So,
well,
there's a lot that needs to be.
I'm sorry, but I have to end it there. You've given us something to think about. Thank you.